Welcome back for another deep dive into all things German.
That's right.
Last time, we explored Germany through its language, but this time we're going to take a different route through the life and work of Joseph Beuys.
One of the most influential and controversial German artists of the 20th century.
Now, you might be thinking, an artist.
Yeah.
What can that tell me about Germany?
Yeah. It's a fair question.
But trust me, Beuys' story is a fascinating lens.
I think so.
To understand post-war German identity, politics, and even the very definition of art itself.
Exactly.
We've got excerpts from his Wikipedia page to guide us.
Great.
Which dives deep into his journey.
Okay.
From his childhood on the Rhine to his dramatic wartime experience.
Yeah.
And ultimately his rise as a teacher, activist, and let's be honest, a bit of an artistic provocateur.
He was all of those things.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Beuys was born in Cleve in 1921, right?
Yes, in 1921.
Yeah, okay.
The son of a merchant.
Okay.
And even as a child, he showed artistic talent.
So not exactly your typical childhood doodles on the fridge then?
Not exactly. Mm. He was already playing the piano and cello pretty seriously.
Wow.
But this seemingly normal upbringing took a sharp turn when World War II broke out.
So at 20, he volunteered for the Luftwaffe.
Yes.
Becoming a radio operator and later a Stuka dive bomber crewman.
That's right.
Wow, can you imagine the intensity of that experience?
It's hard to even fathom.
Yeah.
And then in 1944... His plane crashed on the Crimean front.
Oh, wow.
This is where things get really interesting.
Okay.
And where the line between fact and myth gets a little blurry.
Okay, this is the part I've heard whispers about.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed to have been rescued by nomadic Tatar tribesmen.
Right.
Who nursed him back to health using felt and fat.
That's the story.
Wow.
And whether completely true or embellished, it became central to his artistic choices and the persona he cultivated.
So these everyday materials, felt and fat, become almost symbolic for him.
Absolutely.
Like they represent more than just their physical properties.
Yes. He infused them with meaning.
Okay.
Linking them to his survival, healing.
Right.
And even this profound connection to nature.
Yeah.
You start to see them pop up everywhere in his work.
And it's not hard to see how the trauma of war and that dramatic crash experience would deeply affect someone's art.
Of course.
He returned home, a changed man, carrying those experiences with him.
Yeah.
It's telling that he chose to study art at the prestigious Dusseldorf Academy.
Yeah.
For someone who had just gone through the horrors of war, choosing to pursue art is pretty interesting.
I think so.
Was that a common path for veterans back then?
Not necessarily. Remember, this was post-war Germany.
Right.
A society trying to rebuild itself,
both
physically and psychologically.
So was art seen as a way to process those experiences? Okay.
To find meaning amidst the chaos.
And did his time at the academy mold him into the artist he became?
What?
Is this where felt and fat started appearing in his art?
Well, he did receive traditional training under the sculptor Ewald Matare.
Okay.
So he had a solid foundation in more classical art forms.
So not exactly avant-garde from the get-go then.
No, but even in those early works, there are hints of the unconventional.
Okay.
He started incorporating unusual materials.
Uh-huh.
Bandages, for example, alongside black oil paint.
Bandages?
Yeah.
I see where this is going.
Yeah.
So the felt and fat, those weren't just random artistic whims.
Not at all.
Okay.
They were deeply tied to his personal narrative, to that crash survival story.
Yeah.
They became his signature, loaded with symbolism and layered with meaning.
This is where it gets really interesting for me.
Yeah.
He takes these mundane materials and elevates them to something more.
Yes.
And then there's the Fluxus movement.
Yes. In the 1960s, Beuys gets involved with Fluxus.
Okay.
Which was all about challenging the very definition of art.
I've heard of Fluxus.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones who did those wild performance art pieces, right?
Yeah.
Like Happenings and...
Exactly. They wanted to break free from the traditional confines of art, making it more interactive.
Right.
Unpredictable, even a bit chaotic at times.
Okay, so give me an example.
Okay.
What kind of Happenings was Beuys a part of?
Imagine a piano covered in flowers.
Oh, wow.
Or Beuys explaining art concepts to a dead hare.
He was explaining art to a dead hare.
Yes.
Okay, that's definitely not your typical art lecture.
Not at all.
Yeah.
This was about pushing boundaries, provoking reactions, and making people rethink what art could be.
And he called these actions social sculpture.
That's right.
Okay.
For Booz, art wasn't just about creating objects. It was about transforming society through creative engagement.
So he's using art to make a statement.
Right.
To engage with social and political ideas.
Exactly.
It's not just about aesthetics anymore.
Exactly. And this concept of social sculpture is really at the heart of what makes Bowie such a fascinating figure.
Right.
It's about art as a force for change.
And that brings us to his more provocative side, right?
Yeah.
The part where he really starts to challenge institutions and push those boundaries even further.
Exactly. That's exactly where we're headed.
Okay.
This is where social sculpture starts to spill out of the art studio and into the real world, so to speak.
So he's not content with just making thought-provoking art.
Right.
He wants to see real-world change.
That's the idea. And one of the most well-known examples of this is the Dusseldorf Academy incident in 1972.
Okay, so this is where things get a little heated, right?
You could say that Booz was a professor at the academy at this point.
Right.
And his teaching methods were a bit radical for the time.
I remember reading something about him admitting every single student who applied. Is that what led to the incident?
It is. He truly believed that everyone had the potential to be an artist.
Wow.
Which went against the academy's traditional selection process.
So he opens the doors to everyone who wants to study art.
Yeah.
Which sounds pretty democratic and inclusive.
Right.
But I'm guessing it didn't go over so well with the academy's administration.
You're catching on.
Uh-huh.
This led to overcrowding, logistical nightmares, and ultimately a clash with the authorities.
So he gets fired for being too open-minded about art.
Yeah.
There's a certain irony there.
Right.
Considering his whole philosophy was about expanding the concept of art.
The irony is not lost on me either.
Yeah.
It really exemplifies how Bowie's beliefs often put him at odds with the establishment.
This incident seems to be a perfect example of his social sculpture in action, wouldn't you say?
It absolutely is.
Like he's trying to reshape the very institution of art education.
He's challenging the gatekeepers.
Right.
Pushing for a more inclusive and democratic approach to art. And this act of defiance, in a way, becomes a performance piece in itself.
It's like life imitating art, or art imitating life. I can't tell which anymore.
Yeah.
But his desire for change didn't stop at the art world, did it?
It did not.
He was also deeply involved in political activism.
That's right. Bowie didn't see a separation between his art and his political beliefs.
Okay.
They were all intertwined.
Right.
He formed the German Student Party.
Wow.
Later, the Organization for Direct Democracy through Referendum.
Okay.
And he was even involved in the early days of the Green Party.
Wow. He even ran for office.
He did.
He wasn't just talking the talk. He was walking the walk.
He absolutely was. And this really underscores the central question we've been dancing around.
Okay.
Can art truly change the world?
It's a question that has no easy answer.
Right.
But looking at Bowie's life, it does seem like he believed art could be a catalyst for change, both within institutions and in society as a whole.
He saw art as a tool for social and political transformation. It wasn't just about making beautiful objects.
Yeah.
It was about engaging with the world around him, sparking dialogue, and pushing for progress.
And that's something I think a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah.
Even if they don't fully understand his art.
Right.
The idea that we can all use our creativity to shape the world in some way.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
Bowie's legacy goes beyond just the art world. His ideas about social sculpture and the power of individual creativity continue to resonate with people from all walks of life.
Okay, but we've talked a lot about his ideas and actions.
Yeah.
But what about the actual artwork? What did a Bowie piece actually look like?
Well, his work spanned a variety of mediums.
Okay.
Drawings, sculptures, installations, and of course, those performance pieces he called actions.
So real mixed bag.
Yeah.
What about the early work?
His early drawings were often more traditional in style.
Okay.
Often featuring delicate lines and nature as a recurring theme.
Nature makes sense considering he grew up in the Rhine region.
Exactly.
And later even collaborated with Heinz Sielmann, the wildlife filmmaker.
Exactly. Nature was a source of inspiration for him throughout his life. But as his style evolved, his drawings became more conceptual, incorporating text diagrams and even musical notes. He started referring to some of these later drawings as scores.
Scores?
Yes.
Like musical scores.
Like musical scores.
That's intriguing.
Yes. These scores often served as blueprints for his actions.
Okay.
Those performance pieces we talked about earlier.
So there's this interplay between the visual and the performative.
Absolutely.
The planned and the spontaneous.
Absolutely. And of course, we can't talk about buoys without talking about felt and fat.
Right. The iconic materials.
Yes.
They appear in his drawings, sculptures.
Uh-huh.
And even those large-scale installations, right?
Yes, they pop up everywhere. Remember, he linked these materials to his wartime experience.
Right.
Imbuing them with deep personal and symbolic meaning.
The felt representing warmth and healing.
Right.
The fat symbolizing life force and energy.
Precisely. They weren't just random artistic choices. They were carefully chosen for their evocative power.
Right.
Take his famous fetek. Fat corner, for example.
That's the one with the massive wedge of fat placed in the corner of a room.
That's the one. It was visually striking, to say the least, and conceptually provocative.
I'm trying to picture it, and honestly, I'm not sure what to make of it. Yeah. What was he trying to say with a giant lump of fat?
That's the beauty of bodies. He rarely offered straightforward explanations.
Okay.
Preferring to let his work spark dialogue and interpretation.
So it's up to the viewer to find their own meaning in the fat corner.
Exactly.
I guess it wouldn't be very social sculpture if he was telling everyone exactly what to think.
Exactly. He wanted to provoke thought, to challenge conventions, and to make people question their assumptions about art and the world around them.
And what about those installations you mentioned?
Uh-huh.
The ones that involved entire rooms.
Ah, yes. Buys was a master of creating immersive environments.
Right.
He often incorporated objects with symbolic meaning.
Okay.
Everyday items, natural materials, things that held personal significance for him.
So walking into one of his installations would be like stepping into his mind in a way.
In a way, yes. He created these visual landscapes filled with metaphors and layered meanings.
And sometimes those installations would even incorporate elements of his actions.
That's right. A room might have served as the stage for a performance with the remnants of the action left behind as part of the final installation.
It sounds like his approach to art making was quite multi-layered and complex.
Yes.
And I'm guessing it wasn't always easy to grasp.
Not always, but what's fascinating is that Buys never explicitly explained his work.
Okay.
He wanted viewers to engage with it on their own terms to draw their own conclusions.
It's like he's inviting us to participate in the creation of meaning.
Right.
He's not dictating, he's suggesting.
Exactly. And that's what makes his work so enduring. It's open to interpretation, inviting ongoing dialogue and discussion.
So even though he's been gone for decades, the conversation around his art continues.
It does. And I think what's most important, especially for someone new to Buys, is to understand the overarching principles behind his work.
Okay.
His belief in the power of art to change the world. His embrace of unconventional materials, and his unwavering commitment to sparking critical thought.
Those are principles that go beyond just the art world.
Absolutely.
They speak to a way of engaging with the world.
Right.
Of questioning the status quo, and of using our creativity to make a difference. It's amazing how he managed to connect those big ideas to these simple everyday materials like felt and fat.
Right.
He saw the potential for meaning in everything.
That's a great observation. And that really speaks to his concept of social sculpture.
Right.
Which we've touched on but haven't fully unpacked.
Right. We keep circling back to it.
Yeah.
Because it feels so central to his whole approach.
Mm.
But I think it would be helpful to break it down a bit more.
Yeah.
What exactly did Buys mean by social sculpture?
It's one of those ideas that's both simple and incredibly complex.
Yeah.
For Buys, traditional art forms like painting or sculpture weren't enough.
Right.
He felt they were too limited in their scope.
Too confined to the gallery walls, you mean?
Exactly. He wanted art to break free from those constraints and have a real impact on the world.
Uh-huh.
He believed art could be a powerful force for social change.
So instead of just reflecting society, art could actually shape it.
That's the core idea behind social sculpture.
Okay.
It's about using creative energy to transform social structures and systems.
But that raises the question.
Yeah.
How can art,
right,
something often seen as subjective and personal, actually change something as concrete as society?
Buys believed that everyone had the potential to be an artist.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the sense of creating objects, but in the sense of shaping their world through their actions and choices.
So it's about taking that creative energy and applying it to everyday life.
Exactly. It's like saying our everyday lives can be a form of art.
Good.
If we approach them with intention and a desire to make a positive impact.
That's a pretty empowering idea.
Yeah.
It means we're not just passive observers.
Right.
We can all be active participants in shaping the world around us.
And that idea is still incredibly relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
Think about movements like social practice art, where artists engage directly with communities to address social issues.
Right.
That's a direct descendant of Buys' social sculpture.
So even though he was working in the 20th century,
yeah,
his ideas feel very much alive in the 21st century?
Absolutely. His influence continues to ripple through the art world and beyond.
And it's interesting how social sculpture connects to his political activism.
Right.
I mean, his involvement with the German Student Party,
mm-hmm.
the Green Party, those weren't just hobbies for him, right?
Not at all. For Buse, those political activities were extensions of his artistic practice.
Okay.
He saw politics as another arena where creative energy could be applied to shape a better future.
So he wasn't just making art about politics.
Right.
He was actively engaging in politics as a form of art.
Exactly. He was putting his ideas into action, trying to create real-world change.
It's like that saying, mm-hmm. be the change you want to see in the world.
Right.
He embodied that.
He truly did. And this interconnectedness between art and life, between theory and practice, is what makes Bay such a fascinating and enduring figure.
He wasn't just creating art. He was living his art.
Precisely. Now, before we wrap up,
okay,
I want to touch on one more intriguing aspect of Bay's work.
Okay.
His interest in esoteric and spiritual ideas.
Right. I remember reading about his connection to anthroposophy.
Yes.
What was that all about?
Anthroposophy is a spiritual philosophy developed by Rudolf Steiner.
Okay.
It emphasizes a holistic understanding of the world,
mm-hmm.
connecting the spiritual and material realms.
And Bay was drawn to this.
He was.
That's not something you typically associate with a radical artist and political activist.
I know it seems like an unexpected connection,
yeah.
but Buse was deeply interested in Steiner's ideas,
okay.
particularly the concept of the threefold social order,
okay.
which advocated for separating cultural, political, and economic spheres.
So how did this influence his work, practically speaking?
Well, some scholars believe that Buse's concept of social sculpture was directly influenced by Steiner's ideas.
Okay.
He saw art as a way to bridge the gap between the spiritual and the material world to create a more holistic and harmonious society.
It adds a whole other layer of meaning to his work.
Yes.
It's like there's this hidden depth beneath the surface.
Exactly. And it's this complexity, this refusal to be easily categorized or understood, that keeps people coming back to Buse.
Yeah.
There's always something more to uncover, some new connection to make.
Like a puzzle that's constantly revealing new pieces.
A perfect analogy, he really was a force to be reckoned with.
So what does it all mean?
Well,
I think what's clear is that Joseph Buse offered us a unique glimpse into the complexities of post-war Germany.
He was a product of his time, but he also helped shape that time.
Yeah.
He grappled with the legacy of war, the challenges of rebuilding a nation, and the search for meaning in a rapidly changing world.
And through his art and activism, he encouraged us to question everything.
That's right.
The role of art,
mm-hmm.
the nature of society, and even our own potential to make a difference.
He dared us to think differently, to see the world as a canvas for creative expression and social transformation.
And on that note, we encourage you to explore more of Bowie's work and ideas.
Please do.
See if you can find traces of his social sculpture in your own life. How can you be the artist, the activist, the change maker in your own world?
That's something for you to ponder until our next deep dive into all things German Schuss.
Endlich geht sie los, die Formel 1 Saison 2026. Uns steht ein besonderes Jahr bevor, denn es gibt neue Regeln, es gibt neue Autos und es gibt neue Teams, darunter auch Audi. Die spannenden Fragen zur Formel 1 Saison 2026 haben wir euch in der XXL Saisonvorschau von Starting Grid beantwortet. Dennis Lewandowski und ich, Kevin Scheuren, haben euch auf den neuesten Stand gebracht, haben über alle Teams, alle Fahrer und alle wichtigen Informationen gesprochen, damit ihr top informiert in die Saison gehen könnt und natürlich haben wir auch getippt, gewagt und ein bisschen sicher. Generell solltet ihr euch merken, Starting Grid, jede Woche Montag neu.
Starting Grid. Keep racing.
Dir hat dieser Podcast gefallen? Dann klicke jetzt auf Abonnieren und empfehle ihn weiter. Bleib immer auf dem Laufenden und folge uns bei Twitter, Instagram und Facebook. Mehr Podcasts findest du auf meinpodcast.de.